So we're ready to begin with the second portion of the session. Thank you. And we'll start right away with our next speaker, who is David Paulson, talking about the Rothamsted long-term experiments.
Thank you, and thank you for the organisers for inviting me. I put a few little booklets about some of our experiments down below there. I won't read out my long-winded title. You can read it quicker than I can say it. And it's a particular pleasure to be here during the International Year of Soils, so that's good. Now, it's customary when people talk about the long-term experiments of Rothamsted to show these pictures of our founders, Laws and Gilbert, but they always show these pictures of these two guys as grand old men when they'd done their work. I like this picture of Laws, who started it all, and he started our long-term experiments when he was in his 20s. So if the only thing you remember today, remember that. So for younger scientists here, don't wait. You don't have to wait till you're grand and old. You can do something significant when you're young, and just do it. You might want to consult an old person as well, but just get on with it. And also, it's important, I think, to realise that long-term experiments are not museum exhibits that must stay exactly the same forever. They're living laboratories to be used, and indeed to make changes when necessary, and I'll come back to that a few times. This is an aerial shot of part of the farm at Rothamsted. I'm going to talk about this Broadbalk experiment that started in 1843, and I'll also talk about this Hoosefield spring barley experiment that started about 10 years later, and some others that are not on that one. We're also very, very fortunate to inherit from our founding fathers the tradition of keeping archive samples of crops and soils. This is absolutely amazing that we've got these. They can be analysed using modern methods for all sorts of things that could never have been thought of in the past. Again, this is another aerial shot of the Broadbalk experiment. I'm not going to read through all of this stuff, but it's just to illustrate a lot of changes have occurred in this experiment over the 170-something years of its existence. I mean, one change is that it started off with long plots, more than 300 metres long, but they've now been divided up into 10 sections. We installed new drains under one of the sections in the 1990s, knowing that it would cause a disruption for a few years, but we decided it was worth it. And also, I draw attention to these trees and some grass at the end, which is a long-term set-aside experiment started in 1881, where the wheat was fenced off, and these trees and grass have regenerated since, and I'll return to those later. Obviously, crop yields are important in experiments like this. I'm going to say nothing about them now. There's a poster tomorrow with something about crop yields on it tomorrow afternoon. Right. Let me say something about organic carbon in soil. Again, using these archived samples analysed with current methods, we can look at some of the changes that have occurred over the last 170-something years. Where no fertiliser and no manure has been applied, and I've lost the cursor again, the bottom line where it says unmanured, those soils have reached a low equilibrium organic carbon and nitrogen content, and they've bumped along the bottom for a very long time. At the other extreme, we've got the plots that's had a very high rate of animal manure applied every year, and those have gone up, and they're getting towards a new equilibrium high value. And there's a repeat of that started later. But even some of these sort of quite simple results apparently can become a bit controversial. You can see the treatment that's had inorganic fertilisers and gives a very, quite a big yield compared to the unmanured one. It's a bigger crop. It puts slightly more roots and crop residues back into the soil. And we can measure a slightly higher organic carbon content. This is in contrast to two controversial papers published in JEQ a few years ago, which myself and a few others got into a quite spat in the literature arguing with these. But I felt we were a bit justified because a big review, a meta-analysis by Ladder et al. Later found that trend, a small increase, was by far the most common one when they looked at 100-and-something experiments worldwide. Another point I want to make is that some things going on in soil happen very quickly. I'll talk about some of them later. But other things happen slowly, and also the soil has a long memory. And this is some data. This happens to be organic nitrogen, but carbon follows the same trend in this Housefield spring barley experiment. Again, we've got treatments with either no fertilisers or manures, or inorganic ones bumping along the bottom. We've got the farmyard manure treatments going up, and again, perhaps around reaching a new high equilibrium level. But one interesting treatment received manure for 20 years in the 1800s. Its organic carbon content went up. And the cursor keeps disappearing. We are. Went up, and of course, then the manure application was stopped. So its soil carbon and nitrogen has been coming down ever since. But we can still measure a difference compared with the plots that never had those manure inputs. So soil does remember quite a lot of things. So some carbon has gone into forms that have still been stabilised and are still there. I want to show you another example of that sort of thing, going to this grassland experiment called Park Grass. Now this has been greatly used by botanists and plant population dynamics people, but we've done a little bit of work on soil. So here we've now got a mosaic of plots given different fertiliser treatments and different lime treatments, because some of the plots became very acid as nitrogen was applied. I couldn't resist a nice old picture here. On this experiment and some of the arable ones, way back in the 1980s, we established plots within them where we gave N15 labelled fertiliser at the same rate as the ordinary nitrogen that was applied in the main plots. And in this grassland experiment, we found at the end of the first season, the first year, about 36% of the applied N was immobilised into organic nitrogen in soil. In arable soils, it's rather lower than that. In our temperate situation, more like 15 or 20%, but here it was 36% of a fairly low rate, about 100 kilograms of N per hectare. So within one season, and in fact within a few weeks or even days, some of that nitrogen had entered really quite stable forms of N. So in that sense, its fate had been sealed very quickly. But when we sampled these soils several times during the next 18 years, and 18 years later, around half of that nitrogen that was immobilised within a few weeks of application was still there in the soil. Some of it, of course, had been remineralised, and the green line shows you how much had been taken up in crops over those years, which we measured, small amounts each year. Nitrogen had gone into forms which, for one reason or another, have become really pretty stable, and they got stable very quickly. Now, because this is a sort of a biology session, I'm going to give a couple of examples of perhaps lesser known bits of work that we've done, and this is the role of soil, aerobic soils, as a sink for methane. I have to learn to say not methane, as I would say in English. I was once laughed at. So here are some work done fairly recently with colleagues at University of Bristol. And you can see here some rates of methane oxidation. And you can see it's high in the woodland area. That's the area at the end of the Broadbalk experiment that was set aside from very long-term arable. In the grassland area, it was a bit lower. And in all these arable plots, it was generally speaking lower still. Some interesting things with manure. And in an acid woodland area somewhere else, that was also a regenerating area, it was a lower rate than in the more neutral pH of the Broadbalk site. So we see that there are some negative effects of nitrogen. We first started looking at that back in the 1990s. So soils that have had a history of nitrogen fertilisers, we found, generally speaking, had a much lower rate, or a considerably lower rate, of methane oxidation than ones that had never had nitrogen. There's a short-term effect, but there seems to be a longer-term population effect as well. So that effect seems to exist, but it's more complicated than that, and not quite seen in the same way everywhere. But the land use effect seems to be much larger, going from woodland to grassland to arable. That effect seems to be bigger than the nitrogen effects. We also found that, again, low pH was bad for methane oxidation. But again, even that isn't always reproduced everywhere. Again, in some of this work with the Bristol group, soil cores were exposed, in this case, to carbon-13 labelled methane, and then PLFAs extracted in order to look at the forms of organisms there. And it was found that these so-called high-affinity methanotropes similar to so-called type 2 methanotrophs, we detected all of the soils. In the ones where manure had been applied, there was a shift to a different group, which tends to be associated with rather higher concentrations of methane. But it was interesting that in this work it was found that the amount of carbon-13 assimilated in our soils was actually a lot less than in many soils from other sites, even in the UK. And it looks like, maybe the speculation here, that there'd been a loss of methanotrope population or activity after this long period in arable. The site, the Broadbalk site, we know from maps has been in arable cropping for at least 300 years, maybe even longer. So it looks like the population has been pretty much screwed up by agriculture over that period. But also it's taking a long time to recover, because even the woodland site, the oxidation rate was lower than in other very long-term woodland sites. And also we do have very high nitrogen deposition from the atmosphere, so we think that may have been inhibiting activity as well. I'm going to switch now to another bit of work, a different bit of work on methane oxidation. This is using intact soil cores on this grassland site. And this was work done in collaboration with people at ETH Zurich. And here, the cores were exposed to carbon-14 labelled methane. And so some of the carbon in the methane gets retained in the cells of the methane oxidising organisms. And in this case, the colleagues made thin sections, then did radioautography, so you can get black blobs where that carbon has been retained. And you can look at all sorts of details in terms of the soil structure. I'll just draw attention to one bit here. In this treatment with nitrogen fertiliser, where a section had not been limed and had become very acid, and we know that the acid front, if you like, is moving down the soil, clearly these organisms didn't like the acid conditions, and they've been pushed further down in the profile where it wasn't quite so acid. But there's a whole load of complicated things about methane oxidation in soils that we really don't understand very well, and this is just scratching the surface, I think. Now, I brought in my colleague, Dr. Penny Hirsch, who's a soil molecular ecologist, just to give, I think, just one or two examples of soil biodiversity studies using modern methods here. And there's one paper which you can get the idea of it simply from reading the title of the paper. Starving the soil of plant input for 50 years reduces abundance but not diversity of soil bacterial communities. So we have one site that's either long-term grassland, a part of it was ploughed up and turned into arable, 50, 60 years ago, and then later on a part of that was turned into a bare fallow treatment, nothing grown at all, ploughed every year to kill off the weeds, a very small weed input, and that's it. And soil carbon has decreased, as you would expect. So what Penny and her colleagues did here was to look at the abundance of various organisms here, both invertebrates and bacteria. And all of them, as you'd expect, their abundance was very low in the bare fallow, the dark ones here. Always low, very low numbers indeed. However, looking at the bacteria by molecular methods, the diversity of that low number of bacteria in the fallow soil was not so very different from in the other soils. So again, there's something interesting, I think, about the way that soils can, the population in soils can sort of remain stable in ways that we might not have expected. This is a second example from my colleague's group, and this is using 16S ribosomal DNA studies to look at the overall diversity in soils from our Broadbalk experiment. And this is principal coordinate analysis that I'm assured is subtly different from principal component analysis, but for goodness sake, don't ask me how. And what they found was, if we look on the left-hand side here, that in these red dots here are the arable plots which have had nitrogen, either at a high rate, the filled ones, or a low rate, the open ones. And there's not a there's perhaps some separation between them, but not a huge one. The blue symbols, mostly hidden by the red ones, these are the arable plots that have had no nitrogen. So one of the surprising conclusions, admittedly at this very high coarse level on biodiversity, is that nitrogen hasn't had a big effect on this overall diversity. If you drill down and look at details, then they do have an effect. The brown symbols, significantly, are from the manure treatment, and they are pulling apart. They're showing us a slightly different sort of population here. And if we go over here, we've got the woodland and grass regenerating area, and they're very distinctly different from all the arable ones. And he tells me that the biggest group of organisms in the arable plot, with or without nitrogen, are this group, which I'm told are candidate nitrosospira organisms, which are ammonia-oxidizing archaea. And the dominant group in the non-tilled, if you like, soils are the group Brasirhizobium. Now, most of you will know about a tiny subgroup of them are the nitrogen fixers that form symbiosis with soybean. But I'm told that actually that's only a tiny group of Brasirhizobium. Most of these don't have the ability to fix nitrogen. If you look over on the right, then looking at in a different direction, if you like, a different dimension, the woodland and the grassland are soils there that sort of separate out. So there's a lot of new things here that can be done, and I think form a basis for beginning to understand some of the diversity in soils and how management and land use affects it. So that sites like this can be really valuable for getting a start. Then you can look in more detail either at different organisms or at different sites where different things are happening. I also just want to say a few words about the importance of, I think, of networking between long-term experiments and not just being focused on your own one. A couple of examples. Here's an EU project that my colleague Andy McDonald, co-author on this talk, was involved in called EXPIR. I won't bore you with the details, but as you can see, there's a lot of sites in Europe where various ecosystem measurements are being done. So people are pooling resources, and that and its follow-up have got funding for people to move from one site to another to go and do measurements in somebody else's site, which is very valuable. Another example of networking was going back some years now, where my colleague Dr. Saran Sohi, he had developed a soil physical fractionation scheme, and by using carbon-13 NMR spectroscopy, we drew some conclusions about the different functional groups that were present in the different physical fractions that we could identify. So we were thought these were quite interesting, but we wanted to be sure that this was reproducible in other sites. So again, what we did was, what my colleagues did was to use some other links that we had, and we applied that fractionation scheme to longest-running experiments in all of those countries listed on the right there, some very different environments to ours, including flooded rice soils. And in general, we concluded that what we found in terms of the functional groups present in the so-called free organic matter and the intra-aggregate organic matter fractions, what we concluded from our sites were pretty much reproduced at these others as well. So there's really useful things can be gained from networking and comparing between sites. I could have mentioned, but I haven't got a slide on it, the SOMNET, Soil Organic Matter Network, that we did, and Keith Palstein sitting there is much involved in that, where we got together data from a lot of long-term experiments around the world and use them to test a load of soil carbon models. And I'm going to finish in a moment. So, concluding remarks, long-term experiments can be living laboratories. Don't be afraid to make changes. Don't think of them as museums. But, of course, when you do make changes, consider it first, carefully. You need multidisciplinary management. Don't leave it to the soil scientists alone. You need the agronomists, the entomologists, and all of these people to understand the importance of different treatments or what changes on it. Keep good records, archive your samples, network with other sites, for the reasons I just mentioned, learning about practicalities, but also compare and contrast different environments. But also, so that's good, but I don't like the idea of sort of long-term experiment clubs very much, because that can be very narrow. So I would say link with colleagues who are experts in both new approaches and different issues. And there's a funny picture to show that soil science can be quite dangerous. Thank you very much.